Welcome to the sixth episode of Reverse Swept Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
This is the podcast that, unlike the English cricket team, keeps working and keeps fully professional once the Ashes is over.
Here we are, swinging our beer once again.
Did you...
fully professional.
Can I win some approval for that as a starter? Because I got so much abuse last time. I thought that was quite an improvement.
Well, I'll do the next one and we can compare. We'll open it up to the listeners.
I'm slightly upset by the fact Toby's just admitted that he's never actually listened to a full episode of the podcast after recording it.
Well, moving swiftly on.
We are going to, starting with the cricket of the moment, we're going to deal with England's, the one-day series in Australia in slightly cursory fashion. We definitely don't mean any sour grapes by this. Australia have been very professional, haven't they? Responded very well.
They have indeed. And indeed, if England had won the series, it would have been just as meaningless and just as lacking in interest.
It wasn't really just... It was sort of beyond... It was after the Lord Mayor's show. It was well after
it
the...
It was. I think this is one of the problems with these one-day series, is the fact that they're just tacked onto the end of Test series once the main action is gone. And in 2005, when the... one day as were before, it actually built up quite a lot of interest. It got the teams to have a good look at each other before the main event, which was the test. But now it's just
there's a general sense of England are heading to a World Cup in a state of crisis. That's the kind of media consensus on it. It does seem like a touch of an overreaction. I mean, there's an England side that actually has been pretty solid in the one-day format for a while. There's a couple of players out of form. There are certainly some injury problems. But, I mean,
I can't remember the last time, probably going to be proved horribly wrong here, but that after a big test series, that the winners, and particularly such outright winners as England have gone on to win the one day. I mean, it just seems
made a good point.
It doesn't excuse it, but...
You did make a very good point before we started, thinking back to 2009. England were horrible in the one-day series after that. Frankly, you put all your effort into a series like the Ashes, you have the exertion there, and I can sort of forgive the England players maybe for not being 100%. I just feel like the World Cup will be an entirely different affair. There's a lot of challenges involved with the pitches there. Very different to India. England will have gone away, had a rest, and they'll be more fired up. You know, it's a World Cup rather than a one-day series. But I think we'll move rapidly onwards
given all that, we'll put that.
And say well done. But we don't want to ever be accused. We spent many a minute discussing.
Hearty congratulations.
We spent many a minute gloating, and Australia being professional. I thought Shane Watson an outstanding innings early on in the series, and
Michael Clarke has learnt which end to pick up the bat.
Michael Clarke sorted himself out. Even Xavier Doherty's been back on the scene, which I found slightly astonishing. But the spinner, the sort of Australian party game of, which spinner should we pick today, has sort of continued to be slightly random. But yes, well done, Australia.
Yep.
And we're going to do something far, far more exciting. With the Ashes over, we thought we'd look ahead to the rest of 2011, pick a couple of the key things, key players to be looking out for. We'll start with the series to watch, what you should be looking out for. Do you want to kick us off, Tony?
Yeah, I'm looking forward very much to the Sri Lanka Australia series later in a few months' time. It'll be Australia's second Test series after the Ashes, the first one of which will be against Bangladesh, and which will slightly inevitably be an experiment.
You'd like to think it will be a gentle.
The Sri Lanka series, though, is it's either going to be the beginning of a new era for Australia. They're either going to nail their colours to the mast and say, right, we've got rid of Ponting and we've got this new look side. Or they're going to have not done that. They're still going to have Ponting in the team. They're not going to have changed much. But either way, it's going to tell us, I think, a lot about what Australia are
going to
be
doing. And Sri Lanka are... The interesting thing is Sri Lanka are clearly a good enough side that they would walk all over a very weak Australian outfit. They are good enough to exploit a weak Australian side. And I think you're right. The fascinating question is just what 11 turns up.
Yep.
I mean, who do they go with? I mean, obviously the big name is Ponting. Do we see Khawaja come into the side?
And actually, it's pretty... Australia haven't won a Test series since March 2010 against New Zealand. For them to... I mean, if they're going to kind of put their print on the world game and say we're a force to be reckoned with again, they need to start winning pretty rapidly. And they've had some pretty disastrous losses.
What about the Sri Lankans themselves are very curious. They're consistently good, without perhaps being spectacular. And I wonder, this series might be an opportunity for them. I mean, a big victory over the Australians would be a strong message for them to send out.
And similarly, because it seems to have done nothing but rain in Sri Lanka for the last 6 months.
Yeah, it'd be awful with the West Indies,
exactly,
a non-series.
And some one days very recently, which have all been rained off. It'll be a good opportunity for them to be able to come out and have a little bit of a kind of a post-Murray side, give that a side.
See how they move on from there. Yeah, I think it will certainly be an intriguing series. And I mean, the Australians they desperately need a post-Ashes response, don't they? They need a big result. And they've got this bizarre thing, they have to wait until August till they play any Test cricket.
Talking of post-Ashes result, what are you...
Well, I've gone perhaps for the more obvious choice, the safe option of India's visit to England. I think this is the perfect series for England to have after the Ashes. I think if we're serious about clearly that could be, that's very possible, but if we're serious about this idea of world number one challengers, who better to play than the current incumbents, India?
And similarly with Australia, who need to turn a tide. In England, actually, you've got a very interesting stat about this. England actually needs to turn a tide against India.
I was astonished, actually, by this. I realised England's record wasn't particularly great about India, but they haven't won a series against India since 96. They've only won two of their last 17 tests against them. I mean, the more you look at it, I mean, India really are England's bogey team in Test cricket. They've got a horrible, horrible record against them. And there is a need to sort of get one over them.
From the Indians' perspective as well, they've got this issue of being slightly in transition, and it will be almost certainly Tendulkar's last tour of England. They've got several other
players. Yeah, I mean, we hope he'll go. I mean, we may see retirement after the World Cup, but I think certainly Tendulkar's... I mean, you'll have it'll be very intriguing. I think you'll have Tendulkar and Dravid probably still there, probably Laxman still there. I mean, class act, experience act. But you've got some great young players coming through. I mean, Kohli, Pujara, but with very little experience in English conditions. And I don't think I'm overstating it, but I think James Anderson in good English conditions is as tough a test for a
absolutely
batsman as there is in Test cricket at the moment. England, in contrast, I think, to this India side in transition, look a settled side to me. The batting lineup, for the most part, is there.
I would disagree with them being a settled side, because one of the great things that came out of the Ashes were all of these questions about Finn and Bresnan and Broad and on the bowling side of things, and then we're going to have Owen Morgan probably coming in for Collingwood on the batting side of things. And actually, I mean, it's a good dilemma. It's a good...
I think this is the point. The bowling choice at the moment is an excellent one. I mean, the key question is, can you reasonably drop Tremlett after the way he bowled? I mean, he was just superb. And obviously, Broad comes back in. You know, you've got Bresnan in the mix. It's a nice choice to have. I think we'll see them settle on a group of four seamers. A four pairing. I'm not entirely sure where that came from. It sounded slightly inappropriate. But the idea that I think certainly perhaps the batting lineup is mostly there, and I just think, for India's bowling attack, which whenever you take Zaheer Khan out of it, the seamers just don't quite look there. It'll be a real test for them. I think, aside from anything else, I just think it'll be a great series. I think we'll see close cricket. And I think England have got to win it. I think if we're serious about this idea of challenging number one, it's a fantastic opportunity to sort of make our case for that. But it'll be close, and it'll certainly be very competitive. Moving on, the series to watch, we thought we'd think more about the teams to watch. And you have taken us away from the glamour of international cricket, and you've in fact taken us to the glamour of Chelmsford.
Down to the east coast of England. Essex, who were relegated to Division 2 at the end of last season, they're a side that I've been supporting for a long, long time. They're sort of my local team. And I think they've got a really, really strong squad and quite a stable squad. I mean, they're sort of Bapara, Cook, era are really coming into their own now. And actually, one good thing about the side is that Cook is the only person who's regularly going to be away on international duty, so the rest of the team will be fairly settled. But when you think that they've got a middle order of Bappar and Napier and Ryan Tendrucharty, it's a pretty explosive mixture.
Very potent, yeah.
And alongside that, they've got the kind of Grant Flowers in the setup that I think he's 35 or something now, the really experienced hands there. And they've also got the much younger players, Billy Godelman, who's one to watch, tipping him now.
This is your ludicrous bold prediction for the evening.
As a future England captain. I think they can do they're going to go up and they're going to win.
So certainly they should find that second division relatively. I mean, I watched a decent amount of Surrey last year in the second division, and there is a clear drop off of quality, and you'd like to think that Essex side could have fun there. And they've often been seen as a limited overs outfit, haven't they? I mean, Shah's really got a point to prove.
Yeah,
you
never,
I mean, where do you stand on that? There's this thing with Shah. It's either. Have England given him the fair chance? He's often felt they haven't, or has he blown enough opportunities?
But as a county player, he's I think always someone who you want coming in at any stage of an innings. Really, he's a very adept batsman, and I'm surprised that he's gone there actually from Middlesex.
Yeah, I mean, and it was an odd decision to let him go. I mean, Bappara is an interesting one in that Owen Morgan has jumped the queue, hasn't he? There, Bappara was very much the man in waiting. Yeah. He had a fairly horrible Ashes, well, an utterly horrible Ashes in 2009, and he seems to. There's a bit of the forgotten man about him now. I mean, he hasn't made the World Cup squad either, which for a player who had the limited overs. He really has a case to prove
exactly,
it.
Exactly. I think that's the point. It's going to be one of these cases of having a very close-knit team who are all there with a purpose within Essex to...
The player I'm excited about is this Maurice Chambers, young bowler coming through there. I mean, are you going to predict
quick,
him?
Very quick, very well. He's going to be top of the ICC bowling rankings.
excellent bold prediction.
Exactly.
I mean, it's good to see.
Don't put your money on it. Blame me.
No, it's good to see some young exciting seamers coming through, especially because the English players of sort of West Indian descent have really slipped out of the game. Yep. You know, there's not really been. It's interesting to see sort of him making comeback.
I've
gone back to the international arena. A team that I hope would rival Essex. I've gone for South Africa.
No chance.
I think this is a side now. I mean, in Steyn and Morkel, you have a truly, you know, the opening partnership of Test cricket at the moment. I think Lonwabo Tsotsobe, I'd love to think I've just pronounced that perfectly. I'd love to think I've
probably
just
haven't.
Beautifully nailed that. But the
practicing in front of the bathroom mirror.
But he's a player who, for a while, was seen as kind of gap filler, and has had a really excellent winter against India. I mean, as good a batsman as there are, and they really do seem to now. There's no world-class spinner there. There never is with South Africa. There's this Imran Tahir who's going to come in. We'll see what he does, who they've seemed to appear have just thieved from Pakistan. But at any rate, the side looks very... You know, the batting lineup is excellent. There's a huge amount of quality there. And there is this issue that time's running out for this generation, or at least this generation at the top. You've got Smith, who, in terms of his captaincy... All reports suggest he's not looking to hang around much longer. He may well give up the one-day captaincy, at least after the World Cup. Callis as well. I mean, Callis, a player who I don't think ever gets quite the recognition he deserves. His figures are formidable. And, you know, with bat and ball, and he cannot go on much longer. And the South African team would love to make a proper claim for them as world number
one. But I think this issue of a lack of a spinner is actually will potentially affect them fairly deeply in England. The lack of a holding spinner.
Well, they've got an interesting winter ahead of them. They've got the Australians visiting. We have no idea what state that Australia team will be in by then. They've got Sri Lanka as well. They've got two quite interesting series. I mean, the expectation would be that they would win both of those. And you just feel the world, the test game at the moment is so fluid. They've got a great opportunity to state their case as the number one side. And it'll be interesting whether they can do that, whether they can actually push on. And this choker tag doesn't go away with South Africa. I mean, I followed on Cricket Info recently the one day they had against India where the game was utterly theirs. You know, it was so comfortable. And they somehow contrived to throw it away. You know, the other issue for them is, can they do something at the World Cup? You know, it'd be interesting to follow that. So,
well, it's a make or break here for them.
As a one-day side as well as a test side, we'll think now about the players you should be keeping your eye on this year. And you've gone for, I always think he looks a bit like an accountant, actually.
Dismally predictable.
Jonathan Trott.
He went to Australia with a lot of questions hanging over him, and I think he has... What he's done is he has proved himself to the team in the sense that he now fits into this team in quite a specific way. And if you take Jonathan Trott out of that England batting lineup, it suddenly looks a hell of a lot weaker.
He is great sporting cliche now. He is the first name on the team sheet, isn't he? Especially in terms of the batting lineup. He really is.
And it's not only the quality of his batting, which is very considerable, it's actually the fact that he has the ability to play a wide number of different types of innings, and he seems to be able to read the game very well. And yes, he's not the most dynamic player in tests,
but I think
he's a very, very good person.
But I wonder, perhaps there's been this big move.
Number three, basically,
and there's been this big move in Test cricket. The scoring's got faster. The shot making has certainly got bolder. You know, over the last certainly 10, even 20 years. And with Jonathan Trott, he's a throwback. He is an old school Test match player. He's got the temperament to bat forever. And the willingness to just accumulate and just build and actually build.
That is someone around whom you can build a team. And that's the other reason why he's the first person on the team sheet.
And I remember drawing this contrast when we were chatting about the Ashes, but the difference between sort of the cavalier Peterson and just the consistency and the effect, a consistent and effective Trott.
So are you going to go for consistent and effective?
I'm going to go for outrageous and bold. We're going to go for a 22-year-old bowler with astonishing potential, Kemar Roach of the West Indies.
He keeps his temper.
Right, when he keeps his temper. Two little tales of Kemar that for me caught his attention, caught my attention even. I'll take you back to everyone's favourite tournament, the Champions Trophy back in South Africa.
It's
the very first ball of Australia's innings, Shane Watson to face. And Roach removes Watson with a staggering yorker of pace. It moves off the pitch. It's just an outstanding ball. Watson stands there at the crease.
In sheer disbelief,
he looks to the umpire begging for a reprieve almost, despite the fact his stumps are splayed behind him. And he's one of those bowlers, I mean, he reaches the 90s with ease. One of those few bowlers around at the moment who I think can trouble batsmen for sheer pace. But away from what he does his ability, I think there's something fantastic about his temperament. And this is where you'll disagree with me imminently. But I take you to a very tedious test, actually, against South Africa. South Africa have got the game won. 18 runs needed, 8 wickets in hand. The test is over. And at this point, Roach decides to bowl a spell of staggering aggression to Jacques Callis. You know, as good a batsman as there is around. Well, perhaps slightly bold statement. But, a superbly experienced and very effective batsman. And he strikes Callis in the helmet. He bounces him. He gets in Callis's face. He's giving him the verbals. And I couldn't help but see that and think, West Indies cricket so often recently has been about submission almost. It's been about a willingness to almost lie down and not really fight. And here is a player who, with the game lost, bowled this astonishing spell, showed aggression. I think he's a player with something quite special to him.
So he submits until the game's lost and then...
This is a very fair point. He could have done it slightly earlier. But I think he's a 22-year-old. Let's remember, cricket is a game where generally players take time to mature. They take time till we see the very best of them. And At that age, he's made an excellent start to his Test career. He's taken 30-odd wickets at 28 apiece. I mean, that's great for a bowler of his age. Frankly, not bowling with the best support at all times. And his hostility, for me, is the key. That is the tradition of West Indian pace bowling. Make it uncomfortable, make it aggressive.
It'll be fascinating to see how he goes. And the whole of 2011.
And he's got a very interesting couple of series ahead of him. He's got India coming up. Who knows? He may even get a shot at sort of Tendulkar or certainly India's young generation coming through. He's got Sri Lanka. No, he hasn't. He's got Pakistan coming. You'd like to think those batsmen might be fairly generous towards him. I think he's got a year where he will prove himself, yep. And we will see him as the talked about seamer of the moment.
Look back to 1931 and a series between Australia and the West Indies in Australia, in which it's a bit of a sad tale, really, because West Indies cricket is growing. It's becoming very bound up with the independence movement in the West Indies, and there are all kinds of great hopes held out for cricket being an international beacon for what the West Indies can do and can be as a country. And they go down to Australia and they get roundly thrashed in the first four tests of this series. Bradman has a bit of a field day. He averages 74. Bill Ponsford averages 77. This is the Australia side that goes on.
This is a West Indian team of very limited, test experience, isn't it?
Very limited test experience, but absolutely brimming with talent. I mean, Leary Constantine and George Headley are the two.
Are the lead bats?
Are the two obvious ones? So they get absolutely thrashed in the first four tests, and then they go to the fifth and. There's this kind of inevitability about the whole thing. But what actually happens in the fifth is absolutely remarkable. The fifth test is a timeless test, and the West Indies declare twice, and declaring twice in a timeless test, particularly when you're 4-0 down, looks like suicide.
It's astonishingly bold.
But they declare twice, and they win. And it's the most kind of remarkable statement that they could possibly make, actually. They go out and they score 350 on a pitch that's been rained on for several days. The sun comes out and apparently turns into this absolutely unplayable mire. And so they make 350 with one vital double century partnership holding up that innings. And then Australia come out and... on the afternoon of the second day, and are bowled out for 224 fairly rapidly in 80 overs, which leaves the West Indies with only a lead of 125 on the first innings. They go in on a pitch which apparently everything was moving sideways, and if it wasn't moving sideways, it was spitting up off a length. And they reach 124 for five, very, very slowly, at two runs an over. And then they declare on a close of play on the third day, in this timeless test. So what they've done is they've set the Australians 250 to win. This is an Australian batting lineup that's got in it Woodfull, Ponsford, Bradman, and Allen and Kippax. Stanley McCabe batting at seven. It's a phenomenal Australian batting lineup, but they have the confidence to say, right, we think this is what the pitch is going to do. We're going to leave you 250.
And obviously, with no time pressure upon them.
No time pressure upon them.
I mean, it's almost despair of arrogance, isn't it?
And the West Indies are four. Well, you would think it was despair of arrogance, but they're 4-0 down.
4-0 down.
I mean, it's the kind of thing you do when you're 4-0 up and you want to say to a team, look, you can't even get 250 to beat us.
It's an odd statement to be making, having been hammered. Yeah,
exactly. And well, the Australians never quite get. They get to 220. They fall 30 short, despite the best efforts of the West Indies fielders, who and I think there's something like 25 overthrows in the end of the Australian innings.
That is a determined effort. I mean, that's about an eighth or ninth of the score, isn't it?
Their very, very best. But it's just this remarkable moment. It's the West Indies' first Test win against Australia, and this is the great Australian side, which will go on to play in Bodyline. And just the way they go about it is just so utterly memorable.
It is astonishing that the boldness of the two declarations. And also, I mean, frankly, you're coming out in that test with the prospect of a whitewash there. You know, very much there. And to play with that sort of boldness, I mean, the conditions make it interesting as well. I mean, the West Indies, perhaps, you know, lack of test experience, particularly lack of experience of pitches like that as well. I mean...
Yeah, although having said that, I mean, a lot of the massing wickets they would have played on in the West Indies were pretty dreadful, most of them.
But it was this issue
of it constantly, because there's a rest day on the Sunday, and it was this issue of it constantly raining and then bright sunshine going on the pitch. And I mean, it must have been impossible to read what was going to go on with it. But I mean, the other reason why this series is memorable is that Archie Jackson, the great young Australian batsman who never was as good, better than Bradman. The last test he ever plays is the fourth test of this series. He goes on to have tuberculosis and dies, I think, at the age of 23.
The other thing I find this test reminds you of is the fact that you look at some of the, you know, West Indies now very much an established test side, and you go back to sort of that exciting time where this group of islands that in so many ways were unrelated, you know, had, as you said, that British colonial experience to link them, were just creating something quite special as a sporting team. And you have players like Headley and Constantine. Without those sort of stars, it may never have got off the ground fully. It took performances like that, and it took efforts like that to get it there. Okay, next up is the book review. And this week, thanks to Toby's interesting suggestion, we've been reading Gary Sobers's King Cricket. Tell us more, Toby.
It's Sobers' account of the 1966 series between... England and the West Indies in England, which the West Indies won fairly convincingly. It is, I think, a dreadful book.
But there was no attempt there to kind of quantify that or to maybe give it, like, you know, sort of rating out of five. Kind of we'll cut straight to dreadful.
We'll cut straight to dreadful. The reason I think it's dreadful is to look back before that, the West Indies had a golden age of cricket writing, which was led by C.L.R. James, but there were lots of other people who joined in. I mean, Leary Constantine's another name of cricketers who wrote because they had something interesting to say and they had something vital to say, and actually because they had something politically vital to say.
Right, because the West Indies, I mean, we've talked only a moment ago, the formation was very political, you know, the formation of the cricket team was a political statement. And, I mean, you've got a book here that, I mean... It's ghostwritten in the worst possible way, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. But, I mean, you certainly have this contrast, don't you, emerging between the quality class cricket writing of someone like C.L.R. James and this sort of autobiography. Yep.
And this does seem to be very much looking forward to the later model of sports biography, which is people who... frankly shouldn't be writing or getting other people to write for them.
Or getting someone else who can't really write for them.
More importantly, producing kind of militant accounts of series and just using it to get their points across. Right, I mean, the interesting thing about this is that Sobers goes through the entire way through complaining about the bias of the press, and actually most of his descriptions of everything that goes on is completely one-sided if you read any of this.
Yeah, I mean, there's this axe-to-grind model, and I think you're quite right to say this links from biography, you know, biographies then to biographies of the present. You've got this idea that you write the book to get certain things in the open and make your point. The other thing that upset me, frankly, about it is you've got a fascinating series, and somehow the account of it is deeply tedious. Yep. You're struggling to hang on at times.
Yep. Yep.
It's ghostwritten in such a way that you know you're not reading Gary Sobers, you know you're reading someone else.
And there are these absolutely ludicrous metaphors that pepper the whole...
I was probably most upset by having how you start a book compared to how you open the batting. I thought, we're two pages in and we've had this rather horrible, contrived start.
Even in the third sentence we have, no matter how experienced he is, no matter how calm he seems, there are always a few butterflies fluttering around deep in the cabbage patch part of his stomach.
Right, and by that stage... you know, a weaker man would have put the book down at that stage. We persisted in the interest of research.
We knew we had to tell the world.
We persisted in the interest of research. I blame you. You suggested this book.
Yeah.
What I will say is that I was in terms of notable moments, I was intrigued by the description of Lance Gibbs having bowled 30-odd overs in the first test, coming to Sobers as the captain, with hands covered in blood and still persisting on to bowl. That's probably the thing I'll remember about this book. The idea of spin bowling as an act of sort of self-mutilation. I don't even know if that story is true, frankly.
How
upsetting is that? I find the one lovely moment, and I've now decided that the ghostwriter might have made that up. The worst moment, though, and this seems a little bit harsh, we're dealing with a wonderful cricketer, well, King Cricket, as we are instructed to call him, a truly wonderful cricketer, but in putting his name to his book, there was a particularly horrible moment where he talks about a West Indian bowler who has bowled himself into form, who is bowling brilliantly, who's taken some wonderful wickets, and then
who could land the ball on the head of a pin.
Yeah, does he say,
the
bowler's name was Sobers. And at that point, you think, that was the point at which the book really knows. But frankly, what this is to say is that if you are going to read cricket books, which is an excellent idea, cricket writing over cricket ghostwritten autobiographies almost certainly seems like a good idea. Great cricketer, terrible book.
I think that would be a
very fair conclusion.
Maybe the two lead one from the other. So from the papers this week, well, not really from the papers, from the internet, we've got two very different articles.
Couldn't be much more different. I've been thinking about fat people. You've been thinking about Pakistan. Let's start with you in Pakistan.
Let's start with Pakistan. I've been reading Cameron Abazi on Crick Info, on his Crick Info blog, a piece called "Divide, Rule and Destroy," in which basically he argues that Pakistan, in essence, specifically in the point of captaincy, they need to appoint a captain and they need to stick by him and they need to stop saying, oh, it's not perfect to have a 3D, etc. And they need to just appoint someone. He makes the point that benign dictatorships can be productive, but malevolent ones are destructive, in the sense that Inzamal al-Haq was an all-powerful captain. Maybe he wasn't liked universally, he wasn't perfect, but at least he had a united team under him. And the problem at the moment is everyone's just dithering around, saying it's not perfect, so we can't help thinking
the tragedy, and I mean, Pakistan cricket has got enough to be upset about without the PCB willingly harming their one day. I mean, you come up with the example, you take yourself to England, and you think if at this stage, going to World Cup, England didn't have a settled one day captain, there would be, there'd be bewilderment. No one would know what was going on. It's sad because I think this is a good Pakistan one-day side. I think they've got some great players who are, who could have a World Cup that's in Asia, could be built for this.
It's similar to this. In 2 days' time, the results of the spot-fixing tribunal will be announced. And in a sense, it's similar to that. There needs to be some kind of closure. There needs to be someone who's willing to put their stamp on things and say, right, this is how things are going to be and everyone is going to conform to it. Because otherwise, at the moment, there are so many egos in the team who just will just, without this kind of benevolent dictator, as Abazi calls them, will just cause complete disharmony within a team that can't work like that.
It is fascinating. I mean, Afridi is always an interesting choice as captain. I mean, he's certainly got his tendencies and terms, but you just feel, I think as you said, you've got to settle on someone, back someone, and let this team have a good World Cup. I mean, when has Pakistan ever needed a good tournament more than now? I mean, that's the sadness of it. You know, we expect, I suppose, the verdict of the weekend not to be good. And they desperately need a good series, and it's very sad.
I chose one of the vital issues.
Right, you chose serious matters. I chose fat cricketers, and I thought this was a fantastic article off the Old Batsman blog, which, I don't think it needs to be pitched or recommended, but I think it's as good a blog as is out there. And it was an interesting piece focused on Samit Patel's non-selection for England, and basically asking about some of the issues around these cricketers who don't get picked because of their weight. The one that really interests me is Mark Cosgrove, where you've got a player who, the Old Batsman makes the case that he would walk his way into this current Australian Test lineup, was it not for the issues around his weight. And I can't help feeling, in this pursuit for fitness, in this pursuit for sort of You know, what is it, the 360-degree cricketer. We're forgetting the fact that, frankly, if you can make the runs, you're fit enough.
But I don't think that... I mean, if you're not fit, you're going to get injured. If you get injured and you can't maintain your place as a batsman, you're not going to be part of a stable side. I mean, I don't think it is simply the kind of...
I agree. And you know, there are good reasons for a cricketer having fitness. There are good demands. But you also feel that it gets to a stage where you are harming yourself by focusing on excluding a cricketer purely because of his weight.
Well, there's this whole interesting Rob Key issue, isn't there?
Because
he was... And I don't remember this entirely clearly, but he played in the West Indies series. When the West Indies came to England in 2004, he made a double century, I think. Well, I've certainly made a double century.
Yeah.
And then he never played again. And there was what I wonder is actually whether selectors use players' weight as an excuse not for picking them.
Right,
and there
are other reasons
if they were good enough.
I mean, I think that the point that fascinated me perhaps the most in this article came at the end, this line, are they maverick figures who would actually lose the edge from their game if they conformed? Yeah. And this is interesting to me that actually, it's not impossible for Samit Patel to lose weight, it's not impossible for Mark Cosgrove to lose weight, but actually, these are characters for whom actually playing by the rules and stuff is against sort of their philosophy, and maybe I'm stretching this a little bit too far, but
so
you actually feel like, well, you can't help feeling there has always been a room in cricket for the Maverick. There's more than room for the Maverick. The Mavericks have decided they've been key. We talked about Roach and his temperament earlier. You know, that can lead to a special type of player. Okay, we finish as ever with a debate on a highly, highly critical cricket topic. In fact, we've gone very esoteric, I think, this week. We're focusing on the rise of a new cricket website, Test Match Extra, which has emerged, well, very recently. And, well, we've got sort of mixed feelings about it.
Well, firstly, I think it's fair to say we're not entirely sure what it is.
The website looks a little bit amateur to me.
It looks very amateur. As I was settling into the bath the other night, there is a point to this story. Settling into the bath.
I'm intrigued to see where this is going.
Unwrapped my copy of the Wisden Cricketer. I read at the bottom of the editorial that this issue is notable not only for being an Ashes celebration, it is also the first under our new owners, Test Match Extra. Who seem to have got Jonathan Agnew on side, Christopher Martin Jenkins, various people.
It's a very, very serious website. I mean,
this is the interesting thing. The major shareholders are Lord Marland, who challenged Giles Clarke for the chairmanship of ECB 2 years ago, and Neil Davidson, the former chairman of Leicestershire.
Right, so considerable backing, considerable considerably high-profile writers have been secured for it.
And it worries me.
And it worries you.
It worries me both because there are some really, really... They had a poster in the middle of the Wisden Cricketer, and I don't like that. And there are some horribly laid out pages. Beside that, and they've got a bad website. So apart from being aesthetically unpleasing, I'm slightly worried by the idea of yet another sort of centralised... place for cricket journalism.
Oh, right, another massive site.
Another cricket info, but also more importantly perhaps another ECB, and the ECB's cricket articles are absolutely dreadful.
Yeah, and we've got another sort of... I mean, my feeling is that... I mean, first I'm just interested. It's very early days. Yeah. What will it turn into? I mean, the whole point with cricket media is... The internet there is a diversification there through the blogs, and there is a very healthy, incredibly healthy blogging sector, you know, a fairly healthy, well, not that healthy, but a fairly healthy podcasting section as well.
Getting healthy.
And, you know, getting healthy by the moment. And there is that sort of independent work going on, and actually, you know, does receive kind of considerable support. I'm intrigued by the county coverage. There's been this laying off of county writers. There's a scandal that the Telegraph reported on cricket games, which they didn't send anyone to, and then made up a name for.
That was
particularly sad. I mean, would love to feel that there was still, you know, room for that. It would be very interesting to see whether these websites provide backing for people like that. Will they support full-time county writers or not?
Yeah.
Will it try and do something different to Crick Info as well? I mean, Crick Info has certainly, in terms of the live scorecards, in terms of the stats section, I think has monopolised that side of the market.
What they're saying in this advert in the Wisden Cricketer is they're going to have 9 specialist county cricket writers and exclusive player columns and dedicated pages for all 18 first-class counties with news fixtures.
So there is actually a real willingness to commit to county cricket.
Potentially, but actually saying that you are going to have a dedicated page, I mean, uploading a scorecard isn't huge.
Right.
And having 9 specialist county cricket writers might mean that they all write one piece a month or something like that.
Yeah, it's hard to say at this stage.
It's all very much TPC, but it was just an interesting. I mean, they call themselves the independent voice of English cricket.
Yeah,
which is interesting.
I mean, what I find interesting actually is that they clearly felt there was a niche for this. I mean, Crick Info is so dominant in this, they felt they could do something different. It'll be interesting to see
England and county specific. But it's as you said earlier, it's interesting what the finances behind this might be, because when the Cricketer and Wisden combined their magazines 6-7 years ago, a bit more than
yeah,
that was definitely done for financial reasons. And I wonder whether, I mean, it would be a sad thing if this thing was being created
and
simply
are you,
because money was.
And also, are you going to end up with a situation where you're simply reading the same columnists across lots and lots of different things? I mean, Crick Info is a great example where there are some fantastic columnists there and some very poor ones. And there are these certain names that have just established themselves and that are there again and again and again. And it'll be interesting to see sort of what they go for. But
we'll send them our podcast and see if we can get freelance columnists.
I would like to think that they would, we could do their podcast for them. With great success, I would think. I hope that last bit has been positive enough about Test Match Extra.
Otherwise, they're probably going to sue us for defamation.
Yeah, I don't think you said anything too nasty about it. I think, frankly, we don't know enough about it. We just had a debate about something we don't know very much about. Yeah. But the and you've dropped your headphones.
No, you pulled your microphone off your foot.
Okay, we're going to have a professional finish to a not very professional product. And say
you've got a closing line.
Right? No, we do. We definitely don't have a closing line. And say that thank you for putting up with us for again too long, far too long. And we will be back in 2 weeks where we will say many bold things about the upcoming World Cup.
We'll get excited about one day cricket. We promise.